Hello, and welcome to the Movie Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll have a spoiler-filled discussion about a movie we think you'll enjoy. In this episode, I am joined by my sister Kay, and we're going to have a spoiler-filled discussion on the movie Fahrenheit 451, and this is going to be the 1966 version. There is a 2018 version that was done for HBO. We are going to watch that, and depending how long we talk for the two films, it'll either be the second half of this episode or another episode.
Now, I wanted to watch the movie in general, but part of my thinking was when I realized, wait, they did this, what is this, 50 years apart, give or take?
52.
And, I mean, first of all, it was written in 53. That's when it came out.
Yeah.
But it was really written over the course of a few years. But seeing how in the 60s they were going to handle the future technology, and then seeing how some other team was going to come to it 50 years later and handle the same thing just fascinated me.
Well, I had kind of figured that, again, the duration of time between the two, to do a remake so many years later was going to be interesting. But this one, filmed in 66, was going to have some challenges just in terms of production value, how to do the fire effects safely, which they did beautifully, how they were going to do the parlor.
Yes.
With the wall-to-wall, you know, TV screens. Basically, when that scene happened, we see what looks like, frankly, an unimpressive flat screen TV. Now, granted, for 66, crazy good. Although the scan lines are huge.
Yeah.
But I'm like, that's not what I was expecting. Because, I mean, to put this into context, and I had mentioned this as the film started to my sister, we're watching this with a projection onto a wall with, I don't know, 100 inch diagonal?
Well, I always joke when people ask me, how big is it? A king size sheet?
Oh, probably bigger, but yeah.
But, I mean, just to give people a rough idea of what we're looking at.
What we're looking at is not exactly how they describe the parlor, but it's not. It's more so than what they had in the film.
Yes, but what they had in the film was a very impressive 2020 flat screen TV. When you think about it. Now, mind you, it had three dials on the wall to control it, which was hilarious.
Well, and the other thing, and you pointed this out as soon as we saw it, was the 19th century style telephones.
Yes!
Where you hold the earpiece and you speak into the part on the wall. And
they only had one that had the earpiece.
The handset.
And stuff, traditional handset. And part of why I noticed the ones with the two separate pieces is we used to go stay with some family friends who had a ranch here in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And they had one of those that was so old, it goes back to, you know, pick it up and the operator comes on.
Yeah.
Times. And they'd had it refurbished to where there was this piece of wood at an angle and you could put a piece of paper on it and scribble a note to yourself. They'd had it refurbished to where now that flipped up, and underneath it was where you could punch in the numbers to dial the phone number.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so this was very similar to that, only there was a little thing now, and you did the rotary dial.
Well, the one thing had the rotary dial, but it was funny, because again, it's got the one piece that you hold up to your ear, and the other that's mounted on the wall that you speak to, which is antiquated while they're trying to do this high-tech future thing. And
And when we're at the cafe and we go downstairs to use the equivalent of a payphone.
Yes, they've got this call lobby thing complete with an in-person operator with the plug board.
Yeah.
And then three, you know, extension booths.
Yeah.
That have kind of domes or whatever to give you some privacy or whatever.
Now, don't get me wrong. In the 90s, I went to places. Sadly, in the late 90s, I went on a routine basis to a place where you went to the person and you told them what number you wanted to dial and they told you what booth to go to and they'd connect it. But that was in the Caribbean.
I was going to ask, where was that? Because I haven't seen that.
And, well, and you were paying by the minute, and that's how they could make sure that they were controlling that you paid correctly.
Well, and that's what gave this film a really weird, old-fashioned future aspect to it.
Yeah. Oh, but I loved the train.
The monorail system they had, we checked the IMDb page afterwards, and it was a test track in France that was taken down shortly after the film was done. But it was interesting because they had some really good shots, and then the monorail would stop, and then the ladder would descend down from what looked like the center aisle.
Well, think of it as the monorail at Disneyland, which I think a lot of people are familiar with what that looks like, where the track is at the bottom.
Yeah, this the track was on top.
Yeah, this is the reverse. And that was part of what fascinated me, was this was kind of a hanging monorail.
It was a hanging one, but what got me is when it would stop, there seemed to be like a cut in the film, and then the staircase descended. Like, there was a little bit more to do it, and they just kind of sped it up for the film.
Yeah. Well, and the way the staircase descended, you could see that there was a large portion of where the staircase hid that was just kind of, you know, okay, we don't need to kind of bite into where the people are. But it made me wonder, okay, so how big a square in the center of the car is there that people can't stand here, because that's where the staircase goes down.
Remember, early on in the film, they had to go down to get to the ladder.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's like that's there's right. this center thing, and then off on the side, it's like a double-decker bus. That you go down to the bottom and then go out.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that, yeah. It was very not Americans with Disabilities Act friendly.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. Nor luggage friendly.
Oh, wow, what a thought.
But it was a cool visual.
Oh, it was.
And they filmed most of the stuff in London at Pinewood Studios versus France, where that was. So I'm wondering if it was just the monorail scenes they did over there.
Mm.
And it probably was.
And one or two others, because the field, the monorail.
The monorail and anything adjacent to it. So yeah. But, like, the firehouse itself was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And the truck they had, because again, these are guys who are starting fires, not putting fires out. It puzzled me because it had what looked like a risable chair at the front.
I think
they never used that.
I think that was some kind of viewing platform type thing. Like, if the captain really wanted a good view.
I had expected that they'd put a guy up there as they're aiming this monster flamethrower, you know, thing.
Well, I think that, first of all, I think the director producers got a little realistic. Going back to when we talked about the book, and I was saying there are things you can do in a book you can't do on screen. In the book, if you owned books, it wasn't just the books that got torched.
They torched the house, but the houses are fireproof, so they essentially gut everything in it.
Yeah, well, and then the house kind of crumbles.
Well, no, I had taken it in the book that because all the houses are fireproof, you'd basically be doing a scorched earth and cleaning it out without damaging the structure.
Oh, I see. I had gotten the impression some of the roofs caved, but maybe not. I see what you're saying. Okay, so gotten people restart.
Whereas here, the one house they torch, it's because there were so many books they couldn't get them all out, and it was a flammable, you know, house. It wasn't new enough to be fireproof.
Well, they described it as being condemned.
Yeah, well, because it was so old, it was.
But it's either we pull the books out and we burn them, or in the case of condemned houses, the house goes too.
Well, it's a little confusing because in the first case we see of them burning books, they're gathering the books, hauling them outside, and then torching them outside. Whereas when they finally get to Montag's place, they're having him do it in the house.
Mm-hmm.
Now, granted, maybe it's because the first was an apartment and the other one was a house. I don't know.
Well, and when they get to Montag's house, I think that, well, first of all, there was lots going on apparently at that point, but I think that Montag was sufficiently cheesed at the captain and his wife. You notice the first thing he goes for is the marital bed.
The bed, her TV.
Yes.
And then when he was getting a little tired of the chief, he goes for him. The chief seemed really well-read for somebody who doesn't read books.
Yes, yes. Well, the fire captain's mistake is he goes for the bed. It's, no, aim for the books. He goes for the TV. No, aim for the books. Wait, man, he's already mad at you. Don't be egging him on to be madder at you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and there were a couple of changes from the book.
I felt like there were a lot of changes from the book. A lot on the subtle level.
The major ones were the lack of the professor guy.
Yes.
And on a more subtle level, at the end, the book people were memorizing books versus anyone you've read we could pull out of you.
Well, but beyond that, the book people were, I almost want to say, constantly chanting the book to themselves to refresh and embed that memory.
Yeah, and I get why they would do that, but it annoyed the hell out of me.
Yeah.
Can you imagine trying to learn a new book? I'm trying to read here, and you've got somebody, you know, chanting, you know, Tale of Two Cities, and another one doing, you know, Huckleberry Finn, or, you know, who knows what.
They had, like, 25 books being chanted simultaneously, not all in the same language, as they're kind of walking in circles together.
Yeah, I mean, you've got these people who are aimlessly, you know, milling about, muttering their book. And, I mean, when we watched the kid learn from the father, it's like, okay, I get it. It's like, there's no way I could do that. But it was an interesting concept. Mm-hmm. I preferred the novel's version of, if you've read it, it's in there and we have techniques to pull it out.
Yeah, we can help you recognize what's in your brain, bring it to the surface, and in that sense, remember it.
Well, and to me, that is so much more, I don't want to say believable, but practical.
It's the power of the mind.
Well, it's a matter of, if you've got to actively memorize a book, you're going to get a book if you're lucky.
Yeah.
If it's anything you have read, suddenly you are a library, not a Cliff Notes edition of a book.
Yeah.
And well, if you don't know what Cliff Notes are, read this book. You need to read.
Yes.
There's a Cliff Notes series of pamphlets that are basically, they'll take a book like Fahrenheit 451, boil it down to the essential stuff to where you could read like 30 pages and maybe pass your English lit test.
But more than that, they had a section on these are the themes, these are the symbols.
They took it apart and they analyzed it for you.
There was a study guide in it. And the only reason I mention that is because as the youngest child in the family, I inherited everybody else's Cliff Notes. And I actually went through, I still have the collection of Cliff Notes. I went through them to see if we had it on Fahrenheit 451 to see, and we didn't. But I was curious what had been pulled out from it.
And in fairness, I think there's a lot of value to having something like the Cliff Notes for a book like this, to where you can pick up some stuff you might have otherwise missed. But I think, much like the back matter in the edition we read, it's something to do after you have read the book.
Exactly. Well, and I had gotten one of our Japanese-speaking cousins a version of a Shakespearean play that had Shakespeare kind of down the middle and then margin notes that were kind of a Cliff Notes type thing of, in case you don't get it, the last five lines together come together to mean this in regular English. Because Shakespeare is not easy to comprehend English, even for native English speakers.
Well, having that kind of annotation and stuff is good because it's the difference between aimlessly wandering through a museum and having a guided tour where they're telling you this was done during this period, here's what's important about it, here's why it's in the museum.
Yeah.
Versus, oh, it's a painting.
Yeah.
You know, and I think one of the messages of Fahrenheit 451 is there's a lot you can learn from any book.
Mm-hmm.
Even if some people think, well, it's just going to disagree with some other book, therefore it's got no value. It's like, no. Why does it disagree? Mm-hmm. How does it disagree? Does it do so successfully? Does it not? You know, and that's, there's a lot to take away from that.
Yeah. Yeah. Fahrenheit 451 is definitely about the power of thinking as well as knowledge and information.
Yeah, it's definitely about thinking and stuff and how, in this case, Montag kind of awakens to thinking and such.
I found it interesting that the movie changed Clarice in a number of ways. In the book, she was 17. Here she's 20.
Yeah.
And part of that subtle change is she went from being an idiot teenager, their words not ours, to studying to become a teacher.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and the other difference, and I had known that the actress played a dual role, I was mistaken as to which roles. I had thought that she had played either Clarice or the wife, but that the other role, and I thought it was Clarice, was the lady whose house gets burned down.
Mm.
Whereas here, she plays Clarice, the actress plays Clarice, and the wife. Now, with Clarice, short hair, long hair for the wife. And honestly, I didn't notice.
Yeah, they did very well with that.
But I think part of that for me was also that European flavor of the film.
Definitely. Well, and they were such different characters in every sense. Very different wardrobe, very different approach to life from each character. One character started the film, I almost want to say more comatose, and did kind of awaken, but not necessarily in a positive way.
The wife definitely was that way, I would agree with that.
You know, whereas Clarice was always inquisitive, always bubbly, always full of energy, but also always had drive.
Yeah. Well, and we never saw the two at the same time together for obvious reasons, and hard to do that. But I'm curious why they had the same actress play both roles.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel the trivia page on IMDb really clarified that.
Not that. Other things.
Some other things. It was an entertaining read of the trivia page because it starts out with how the lead actor cut his hair to cause a continuity problem for the director whom he hated at the end of the film, and how the producer, the director, and the lead actor hated each other by the end of the film.
Oh, gosh.
And it goes on as to how there were some definite differences in mindset between the director and the lead actor.
Well, one of them, though, was an interesting... I almost get where one was coming from. I definitely get where the other was coming from. But there has to have been middle ground. In terms of, if you come from a society that has discarded books, given up on them, decided they hold no value. And I want to say this movie did a great job being part of a post-literate society.
Well, yeah, when it starts with its opening credits spoken, not written.
Yes.
There was not a single written word other than on the pages of a burning book.
Yeah.
Or a not burning book. Until the end credits.
Yeah. We had numbers. That was it.
We had some numbers for photo references or whatever. That was it. And I don't even think we had Fahrenheit 451 as the title of the film.
Mm-mm. We had the 451 on the station and the collars.
Yeah.
But that was it. So, yeah. So, if you're in a society that has just sort of cast aside books as almost like the buggies that the horses drew.
It's old technology. It's discarded.
Yeah. And it's got a bad rap. It's a safety hazard. You see one of them buggies the horse draws, you just burn it so nobody can get in that death trap. How would you react the first time you saw one? Is basically this question.
Yeah, but that to me was the wrong question. Because if you've got a fire department of people, and there were dozens of people in that one firehouse.
Yeah.
For the explicit purpose of finding and burning books.
I loved the sample books. They had one that needed to be bendable, so it was blank pages, and all the rest were wood.
Yeah, but they were all, you know, blank pages. So you've still got something to make and bind books.
Yeah.
Blank though they may be. But it's not like these people have never seen a book, and they're not wondering what the hell it is.
Yeah.
They can identify it, they just think it's contraband and needs to go get burned.
Yeah.
So when the IMDb page, trivia page, was saying the director thought, oh, he should be sniffing at it, like, what is this? I'm like, that's stupid.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there was the director's side, there was the actor's side, and then I do think there's a third of what would have been the right thing to do.
Yes. Yes.
And the actor, the lead actor, did okay, but had an accent. And it helped make the film feel kind of more European and a little alien.
Yeah.
And the person they, I think, tried to get to begin with was Terrence Stamp, who later went on to play Zod in Superman 2. And I think that would have been a very interesting choice. Whether it would have worked or not, no idea. But I think it would have made it a little more accessible. And while this director was passionate about making the film, I don't know that he was the right director for it.
Well, I probably for the first half of the film, I felt like there was a lot of change in terms of, like, going to the school where Clarice was teaching to get her belongings because she'd been fired and discovering kids are now terrified of her.
That never made sense to me. And her departure from the town, radically different from in the book.
Yeah. Yeah. It was kind of a, there was something happening there that wasn't explained enough for me.
The kids are now terrified, but why?
Yeah.
You know, so that definitely was a change. And the whole going to a school to begin. Okay, we go to the school. We see these kids come down the hallway, see her, and they're just terrified. These kids are 3 feet tall tops. So, 6 maybe?
Yeah.
Now, we're looking down this hallway that's got doors to presumably classrooms or whatever. And there are these hooks.
Yes.
For the coats and stuff.
Yeah.
The school coats or whatever that the other kids were wearing. But these coats are for, like, teenagers.
Uh-huh.
And they're at a height that these kids we've seen in the school could not reach.
I don't know if they jumped.
They need a ladder. That was one of those where it's like, disconnect.
Yeah.
Did you tell the people creating the set what age actor you were going to have as the school kids or vice versa?
No. Well, and then we went to the park, I think before that, to roust everybody and see if they had books.
In the novel, it was the police who would go square that away. Here, it seemed to be the firemen that would just randomly do searches in case you might have had a book, because that's how common books are.
But it didn't make sense because, well, at least according to the book, the firemen only responded to reports and alarms.
Well, in here, they had a box right outside the fire station to go drop the photo in somebody who had suspected books. No proof needed. We'll just go torch their place.
Yes. I love that. Please make sure to bring us a black and white headshot of the suspect.
Yeah. That... It was funny how much of the story took place in that block of that street where you had the fire station right outside it. You had that informant box across. You had that cafe that they had the discussion in and whatnot. There were a couple of things where, because there was also the staircase up just outside the fire station to go across the street where Clarice kind of bumps into Montag and stuff, but they're coming at opposite directions, even though she had just left the same tram car that he was in.
And been following him.
And been following him, got in front of him somehow.
That's one of many continuity errors. I mean, her house moved sides of his house.
Yeah. That was something where, I get there, it's a film, does it matter? But it chips away at the reality.
Yes.
And also, I thought the layout of his house
was bizarre.
The bathroom was as big as the master bedroom.
The master bedroom was connected to the front hallway. I can almost mostly work with that. The bathroom, I can work with that for sure. And the kitchen.
All the rooms seem to almost be interconnected.
I don't need a house where the kitchen is connected to the master bedroom.
Yeah, I agree with that. It served its purpose narratively. But
the kitchen was very small. The table for two people almost filled the center of the kitchen like it was the island.
It did, but let's keep in mind how functional this kitchen was.
I was going to say the oven.
Because she reached into the oven with no oven mitts to get the TV dinners out that she had presumably just cooked. And it's like, oh, they're cold. I mean, I don't expect utter realism in every film I watch.
No, but that was funny. Because my response to that was, wow, they really did predict TV dinners.
My thought was, he's a fireman. Whether he's setting or putting out fires, he understands heat hurts.
Yes.
So I think this is a director that first English film, first color film, and only English film, actually. He was for a different audience than I belong to.
Yeah. Well, he had some stuff that was artsy in terms of zooming in on some of the pages of words that burned. But some of the shots of the burning books, I mean, as much as it's sacrilege to me and just tore at my heart, It was beautiful.
I think they had a second unit that spent quite a bit of time.
Yeah.
Burning books, trying to get that right shot of them.
Yeah.
Some of it may have been time lapse, may not have been. It was hard to tell.
I mean, just the way that the pages would kind of pull out the binding.
Yeah, curl up out of the binding.
Oh, and, wow.
Yeah, it was that. Some of that was well done, which in and of itself is a shame.
Yes.
Because just when they were throwing the books around, it's like, I can't do that.
Yeah.
So many books were harmed in the making of this film.
Yes, undeniably. And that doesn't count the burning.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think Ray Bradbury would be in favor of that, but it being done in service of his story.
If it teaches a lesson.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Cautionary tale.
Yeah.
So I think they did some good stuff. It felt a little slow in places, but not excruciatingly slow.
Mm-hmm.
But given that they had taken one or two characters like the professor just out entirely.
They tried to bump one of the firemen up. Fabian.
Well, sort of, because there were two or three of the firemen that played poker or whatever in the novel that we never really get here.
I think they all coalesced into Fabian, and he kind of bumped up to more speaking part, and he, in some ways, he was almost the hound, but he was also the, he was the one who saw Montag take a book.
Yeah.
He was the one who saw Montag at the cafe with the neighbor.
He looked just enough like, I think it's Lance Legault who played Decker in the A-Team.
Yes. Yeah.
That I just thought that was funny. What did you make of the two firemen rookies or whatever that were getting yelled at and whatnot? It's like something was going on there. I just couldn't tell what.
I never knew what to make with any of the training part.
There were some, I don't want to say subplots, but side things hinted at
mm-hmm.
that were just totally lost on me.
But it goes back to what I said about the novel. Everything pulled together in the novel. Nothing was extraneous. Nothing was discarded. Nothing was forgotten.
Well, and maybe that's why those things stuck out at me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I agree with you when we talked about the novel and you said it came from a short story. It had its roots in the short story. But the novel slash short story could have had the, while he was at the fire station, he went to check on the trainees. But he didn't divert to the extraneous stuff.
There was nothing irrelevant there, whereas yeah. here there were things, there was little moments of business that didn't add to the story and served as a, well, then why did you show it to us?
Yeah, I mean, we went to the trainees because that was supposed to reinforce how good they are at searching, but we had the scene where we searched the apartment, and God bless the guy who decided to store books on top of his radiator.
Yeah, that was about as brilliant as putting them in the toaster.
But I kind of want the TV that's a fake book library.
I'd want one with a shelf. Yeah, I think there was a aspect of either the director or at least the set designer that equated avid readers with hoarders who just stack things, you know.
Yes, the abuse the books took by their owners.
Not just the abuse, although there was certainly tons of that. There were a couple where they were just crammed in shelves, stacked in a way that you couldn't get any of them out.
Yeah.
It was so non-practical.
Yeah.
And I get that, you know, particularly when you're dealing with paperback novels, you know, it just doesn't always work as well in a shelf where the shelf is twice as deep as the paperback novel and, you know, twice as high as the paperback. So I do have some bookcases upstairs where I've got one row of books, another row in front of it, and then another on top of it, another on, you know, in front of that. So some of them are very hard to get at, but I've read them.
I do too, but I don't have them stacked 18 tall and kind of interwoven.
At odd angles.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious in the more modern film how the parlor's done,
mm-hmm.
how the books are handled. In other words, do they seem like a legit library or...
Yeah.
You know, some kind of bizarre hoarders thing.
I was unsurprised. No hound here. I thought 66, hard to do the hound. 2018, I kind of want to see the hound.
The hound I'm expecting. I'm expecting digital flames.
Yeah.
In the new one. But the use of the pole, as is there some disagreement with you and the pole or whatever.
Oh, that was funny.
Was, I think, in place of the hound.
Yeah, probably. And if they had found some way to kind of do a, the pole recognizes who's grabbed hold of it, or the pole only responds to firemen on duty, or something like that, that would have helped.
They had the hints of, you know, biometric security and stuff, but only the hints of it, and it was, yeah, mm-hmm. they could have done that better.
And they had the doorbell camera.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was hard for me to tell if it was a camera or just, like, a bizarre magnifying lens.
It seemed to be a camera screen okay. hookup. And then they had the automatic doors at the house.
Yeah. Well, and they had a few of those, I think, at the fire station or whatever, up until you got to yeah. the chief's, in which case it was a manual one.
Yeah, so we could unlock it later.
Yeah. But the automatic doors felt like really, I want to say low-rent Star Trek ones.
Yes.
You know, they were doing the same thing, but it felt amateurish. And it was a decent film, but I knew going in it was going to feel dated.
Mm-hmm.
It was unlikely to hit some of the cool aspects of the parlor and a few things like that. And just from the photos I'd seen on IMDb, it felt very, again, European mm-hmm. or off.
Yeah.
From my sensibility.
I wish it had been as tightly woven as the book.
Same here, but I'll be honest, I think the film worked better for me than I was afraid it might.
I'll agree with that.
But I do think that the HBO 2018 version is more likely to be in our sensibility
mm-hmm.
in terms of it being more modern, it being, I think, a bit more explicitly made for an American audience.
Yeah.
And I think having a more contemporary, accessible set of actors.
Yeah. Now, one of the things they did in here was a hilarious scene where Montag talks to one of the neighbors, and she basically points out you can look physically at the outside of the houses and know who's strange.
It's funny because until she did that and they're zooming in on the TV antenna for all the houses,
yeah,
the opening credit made no sense to me.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Because it was constantly zooming in on TV antenna after TV antenna as the guy's reading the opening credits.
Yeah.
So that was, there's definite, I don't say anti-television kind of vibe to it, but.
No, but there's definitely a recognize that there is value and importance in information, in thinking, in the written word.
Yeah, but one of the other things that the chief kind of hints at, and I think it could have been stated more explicitly, is the problem with books is there's so many and they don't agree.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas there's only the one TV channel.
Yes. Yes. Well, and so many people say they feel like they know the weatherman. Well, heck, I refer to our local weatherman by his first name, and I tease Mom mercilessly. He's going to be too excited tonight. We've got a storm coming, because I know how he reacts to certain things.
Well, it's funny, because when I first came to Austin here for college, and I'm watching the nightly news, and I remember the first time I'd watched it, because it really made me wonder what the hell I'd gotten myself into. Because here I was coming from Southern California to the middle of Texas, definitely some culture shock at that point. And the newscaster was announcing the end of a great state tradition, drinking and driving.
Yes.
I'm like, what the hell? They call that a great state tradition?
Yeah.
But your whole comment of feeling like you know the newscaster, I kind of felt that way. But that's another story.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the whole, there is no, I mean, they refer to the family and stuff in this.
They refer to the equivalent to the newscaster as our favorite cousin.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought the audience was the cousin and the rest is the family. So you're part of the family, but not the central part.
Right, but the newscaster
okay.
was the cousin.
Yeah, yeah.
Because at the end, he says, come on, our beautiful cousin is on talking about the chase.
Yeah, yeah. It's the whole single family, you know, as the TV people.
Mm-hmm. But that's the thing. They've created a society there where everybody has connected to the people on the screen who they recognize as actors.
But that's where I think history has diverged from what this was putting out there. Because if you think about it, back in the 50s, you had ABC, NBC, CBS.
Mm-hmm.
So at most, three families.
Yeah.
Now in this day and age, you've got a bazillion opportunities, and there's not the odds of going into work the next morning, back when we would actually go into work, and having that water cooler conversation and have most of the office having watched what you watched.
Well, but take that, what you were saying about the 50s and 60s a step further, because most people were talking about Ozzie and Harriet, / the Nelsons.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think, there were one or two other families.
But that's the thing, is there were only the two or three other families.
But they genuinely were families, is yes, my point.
They were families.
And that, I think, may be part of what this drew inspiration from.
No, I think so, but it was also a matter of more people were likely to have seen it because there was, frankly, very few other options.
And I'm not disagreeing. Yeah. I'm just saying that I think part of the inspiration for the idea is back when everybody was talking about Ozzie and Harriet, who were a real family.
Well, and I think even getting into later decades, there were particular sitcom family units that everyone could just sort of identify with at some level.
Well, and now we've got the whole, we're bringing them back. The Full House family is coming back. Who's the Boss just announced they're rebooting.
Oh, wow. I hadn't heard that one, but yeah.
Yeah.
Everything old is new again.
Yeah.
So overall, I thought this was good. It felt a little light story-wise.
Yeah.
But part of that was, again, origin in a short story that got expanded to a novel and stuff. And part of that was, while I think it was a reasonably faithful adaptation, I felt it lost a little in the translation. And I'm hard to put my finger on why. I don't feel it raised the level of the material.
Definitely not. But I don't think it really hit on either censorship the way the book does, or on how the slippery slope can happen in terms of the book goes through the digests and how people can just...
How did they get to there?
Yeah.
It's totally eliminated from it. You're right.
Yeah.
Those are the sorts of things that I think made this lesser experience than the book.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious about the 2018 version.
Yeah, me too.
So we'll watch that, see what we have to say. That'll either be as part of this episode or part of another one. We'll see how it goes.
The show notes and form for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.